You're listening to the Triangle Radio Reading Service, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, serving the blind and print-impaired communities since 1983. This is Nancy Jones. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from the March 2018 issue of Vanity Fair magazine. This is Vanity Fair Part A. The man in the chief of staff suit. A roomful of his predecessors advised incoming White House Chief of Staff Reince Priebus on how to create a functioning presidency. None could imagine what he would face. In an adaptation from a new edition of The Gatekeepers, Chris Whipple gets Priebus's first detailed account of his 6 months with Donald Trump. Opening photo, Reince Priebus, with President Donald Trump in the Oval Office, January 2017. This article is adapted from a new edition of The Gatekeepers, How the White House Chiefs of Staff Define Every Presidency, by Chris Whipple, published in paperback on March 6, 2018, by Crown, an imprint of the Crown Publishing Group, a division of Penguin Random House, LLC, copyright 2017 and 2018 by the author. Just after 6 a.m. on January 21st, 2017, at his home in Alexandria, Virginia, Reince Priebus was watching the cable morning news shows, getting ready to leave for the White House. Suddenly, his cell phone went off. It was Donald Trump. The new president, sworn in less than 24 hours earlier, had just seen the Washington Post, with photos showing Trump's inaugural crowd dwarfed by that of his predecessor Barack Obama. The president was livid, screaming at his chief of staff. He said, "This story is bullshit," recalled Priebus. He said, "There's more people there. There are people who couldn't get in the gates. There's all kind of things that were going on that made it impossible for these people to get there." The president said, "Call Interior Secretary Ryan Zink. Find out from the Park Service. Tell him to get a picture and do some research right away." The president wanted his chief of staff to fix this story immediately. Priebus tried to talk Trump off the ledge. "It doesn't matter," Priebus argued. "It's Washington, D.C., We're in an 85% Democrat area, Northern Virginia's 60%, Maryland's 65%. This is a Democrat haven, and nobody cares." But Trump was having none of it. Priebus thought, "Is this something that I really want to go to battle over on day one? Who needs a controversy over the inauguration?" Priebus realized he faced a decision. Am I going to go to war over this with the President of the United States? Hours later, Press Secretary Sean Spicer stepped into the White House briefing room. What happened, Priebus remembered, was Spicer decided to say that actually, if you combine online and television, radio, and in person, it was the most watched inauguration. The trouble with that reasoning was that Spicer's response, a belligerent Orwellian performance beamed around the world, was a lie. From the very start, the credibility of the Trump presidency became a laughingstock, immortalized by actress Melissa McCarthy in her devastating parody of Spicer on Saturday Night Live. On day one, instead of going to war with Donald Trump, Priebus had gone along. Priebus cannot say he wasn't warned. Just a month before the inauguration, he had been invited to lunch by Barack Obama's outgoing chief of staff, Dennis McDonough. Following the example of a memorable breakfast hosted 8 years earlier by George W. Bush's chief, Josh Bolten, when 12 former White House chiefs had come to give advice to Obama's incoming chief, Rahm Emanuel, McDonough was joined by 10 chiefs, Republicans, and Democrats, in his West Wing office. And as they gathered around a long table, None doubted the enormity of the challenge facing Priebus. "We wanted to help Reince in any way we could," said Jack Watson, who served President Jimmy Carter. "But I don't think there was a chief in the room that thought he was going to be able to do the job, given Trump as his president." Most of the former chiefs believed Trump was intellectually and temperamentally unfit for office, and few thought Priebus could rein him in or tell him hard truths. "We were thinking, God bless him, Godspeed, good luck," said Watson, "but he doesn't have a prayer." Priebus was hobbled by two other factors. A former Republican National Committee chairman from Kenosha, Wisconsin, he barely knew his new boss, and he was part of the establishment that Trump had vilified. Moreover, during the campaign, the two men had been known to feud. Trump had been especially resentful of Priebus's reaction to the campaign's existential crisis just a month before Election Day, the release of the tawdry Access Hollywood tape, in which Trump had made graphic misogynist comments that were caught by an open microphone. The morning after the video surfaced, Trump's candidacy had been pronounced all but dead in the media. In response, the beleaguered nominee's top aides, campaign CEO Stephen Bannon, former New York Mayor Rudy Giuliani, New Jersey Governor Chris Christie, Jared Kushner, and Ivanka Trump, gathered at Trump Tower for a war council to advise the candidate on whether he should stay in the race or quit. The nominee, sleep-deprived, surly, his jaw clenched, posed the crucial question. In light of the videotape, what were his chances of winning? Priebus went first. "If you decide to stay in, you will lose in the biggest landslide in American political history." One by one, Trump's other advisors danced around the question, until finally it was Bannon's turn. 100%, he declared. 100% you're going to win this thing. Metaphysical. Priebus recalled things differently, saying no one was that emphatic. Trump, of course, pulled off an astonishing upset. And a month later, McDonough met his successor as chief of staff in the West Wing lobby and escorted him to his office. As the former chiefs went around the table, giving Priebus advice, they were unanimous about one thing. Trump would be unable to govern unless Priebus was empowered as first among equals in the West Wing. Trump's incoming chief dutifully took notes on a yellow pad. Suddenly there was a commotion. Barack Obama was entering the room. Everyone stood and shook hands. Then Obama motioned for them to sit. The 44th president's own chiefs, Rahm Emanuel, Bill Daley, Jack Lew, McDonough, and Pete Rouse, who served unofficially, were all present, and Obama nodded toward them. "Every one of these guys at different times told me something that pissed me off," Obama said, flashing his familiar grin. "They weren't always right. Sometimes I was. But they were right to do that because they knew they had to tell me what I needed to hear rather than what I wanted to hear." Obama looked at Priebus. "That's the most important function of a chief of staff. Presidents need that, and I hope you will do that for President Trump." With that, Obama said his goodbyes and departed. The chiefs were not sure Priebus got the message. I caught the eye of several of the others, and we exchanged worried expressions, one Republican in attendance remembered. He seemed much too relaxed about being able to navigate a difficult job. I think he struck a lot of us as clueless. Another was even more blunt about Priebus's nonchalance. He was approaching the job like it was some combination of personal aide and cruise director. Dining alone with Priebus a few weeks earlier, Bush's chief, Josh Bolten, had been alarmed. Priebus seemed to regard himself as Trump's babysitter and had given little thought to governing. I could tell that he was nervous about leaving Trump alone, and was kind of candid about, "If I'm not there, Lord knows what happens," Bolton recalled. In his view, Priebus seemed neither focused on organizing his White House staff nor in control of his own life. He was just responding to the fire of the day. And there was another ominous sign. Obama's staff had spent months preparing voluminous transition briefs, thick binders designed to help the next administration get up to speed on subjects ranging from Iran to Cuba to climate change. Every previous incoming team had studied such volumes with care. But as the inauguration drew near, McDonough realized that the binders had not even been opened. All the paperwork, all the briefings that had been prepared for their transition team went unused, he said, unread, unreviewed. The inept start of the Trump presidency, with the flagrant lying about crowd sizes, confirmed the ex-chief's worst fears. "It told me that Reince wasn't in control," observed Jack Watson. "It told me Reince had no power to say to the president, 'Mr. President, we can't do that. We're going to get killed if we do that.'" George W. Bush's first chief, Andrew Card, watched with a sinking feeling. "I said to myself, they don't know what they're doing. They have no process, and they don't have discipline. You must taste your words before you spit them out." In late October 2017, almost 3 months after he resigned as chief of staff, Priebus met me for dinner at a posh but empty restaurant near the White House. Wearing a blazer, tieless, and without his usual American flag pin, he had been off the radar and had given no extensive interviews since his abrupt departure 6 months into his job as Trump's chief. Unlike his friend Sean Spicer, who had struggled to find employment after his turn as Trump's disgraced White House spokesman, Priebus had landed back at his old Washington law firm, Michael Best and Friedrich LLP, as president. He was drumming up paid engagements on the lecture circuit, and he was conferring frequently by phone with Donald J. Trump. "The president," Priebus said, "speaks with him often on a phone that is unmonitored by John Kelly, who replaced him as Trump's chief of staff, sometimes just to chat, sometimes for counsel. Trump often called Bannon, too, at least before his excommunication, following his comments in Michael Wolff's book Fire and Fury." Priebus insisted, contrary to Wolff's description, that he never called Trump an idiot. "In fact, for all the humiliation he endured," he said, "I still love the guy. I want him to be successful." While visiting South Korea last November to give a speech, Priebus made a side trip to the demilitarized zone between South and North and recommended to Trump that he go there during his Asia trip. The president and his party tried, but were forced to turn back due to bad weather. Even so, Priebus's account of his tenure as Trump's chief confirms the portrayal of a White House in disarray, riven by conflict. "Take everything you've heard and multiply it by 50, Priebus said as we sat down. Being White House chief had been even more arduous than it looked from the outside. "No president has ever had to deal with so much so fast. A special counsel and an investigation into Russia, and then subpoenas immediately, the media insanity, not to mention we were pushing out executive orders at record pace, and trying to repeal and replace Obamacare right out of the gate." Priebus was nervous, repeatedly asking, "This is all off the record, right?" He later agreed to be quoted. "People mistake me for a laid-back guy from the Midwest," he continued. "I'm much more aggressive and much more of a knife fighter. Playing the inside game is what I do." Before Priebus, 45, accepted the job, he had had an impressive, if modest, track record. "I took the RNC from oblivion," he explained. Our team raised a ton of money, built the biggest full-time political party operation ever, ran two conventions, won more races than anyone else, and hit all the marks, without drama, mistakes, or infighting. At first, Priebus had been stung by the relentless criticism of his White House run and was especially sensitive to the brickbats hurled by the pundits. But with time, he had understood where they came from, including a jab or two thrown by me during interviews on television news shows. "You got me real good one time on Fox," he said. "My point is, I know what you were saying. You were saying that Trump needed someone in control and that we had set up a weak structure. But you have to remember, the president was the Trump campaign. The RNC was the organization, but he accomplished almost everything in his life by himself. The idea that he was suddenly going to accept an immediate and elaborate staff structure regulating every minute of his life was never in the cards. One of the things all the chiefs told me, Priebus said, was, don't take the job unless you're designated A number one, in charge of everything, beginning to end. All of that was right for a typical president, Priebus thought, but Trump wasn't typical. He was one of a kind. As it turned out, there was a moment on election night when it looked as though the chief's job might go to Bannon, who eventually became Priebus's ally in the West Wing. Others would be considered as well. But he didn't look the part. Trump looked around, and I remember I had a combat jacket on, and I hadn't shaved in a week, said Bannon, who spoke with me at length just before the release of Fire and Fury. I had the greasy hair hanging down. I'm the senior guy, but look, it was obvious Reince had to be chief of staff. Priebus, however, would be chief in name only. Trump, instead, anointed Bannon as Priebus's co-equal, with Bannon, Trump's chief strategist, getting top billing. From the beginning, Priebus would face a unique challenge to this presidency: how to curb the commander-in-chief's tweets. We can get thrown off our message by tweeting things that aren't the issues of the day, he told Trump. At first, Priebus thought he had succeeded in wresting Trump's phone from him. I talked about the security threat of having your own cell in the West Wing, and got the Secret Service to go along with me to mothball his phone. Priebus had managed to silence one device, but it turned out Trump had another. Early on, the staff wrote daily tweets for him. The team would give the president 5 or 6 tweets every day to choose from, said Priebus, and some of them would really push the envelope. The idea would be at least they would be tweets that we could see and understand and control. But that didn't allow the president to be fully in control of his own voice. Everybody tried at different times to cool down the Twitter habit, but no one could do it. After last year's joint session of Congress, we all talked to him, and Melania said no tweeting, and he said okay for the next few days. We had many discussions involving this issue. We had meetings in the residence. I couldn't stop it, but it's now part of the American culture and the American presidency. And you know what? In many ways, the president was right, and all of us so-called experts might be totally wrong. Trump is a man who fears no one and nothing, continued Priebus, and there is absolutely nothing he's intimidated by, and that's very rare in politics. Most people in politics are people who have sort of an approval addiction. Now, granted, President Trump does too, but he's willing to weather one storm after the next to get to an end result that most people are not willing to weather. He doesn't mind the craziness, the drama, or the difficulty. As long as an end goal is in sight, he will endure it. Soon after the inauguration, the president began to lash out wildly at members of the Justice Department who were poised to open probes into possible misconduct or overreach by members of his administration. On his 11th day in office, he fired Acting Attorney General Sally Yates for refusing to enforce his controversial travel ban. Then Preet Bharara, U.S. Attorney for New York's Southern District. Next up, FBI Director James Comey. Priebus and White House Counsel Donald McGahn tried to stall the freight train coming toward them, sensing that sacking Comey would be a fateful political mistake. But Jared Kushner supported Trump's decision, and Deputy Attorney General Rod Rosenstein's memo criticizing the FBI director's handling of the Hillary Clinton investigation gave Trump the pretext. On May 9th, Trump fired Comey. It would trigger the appointment of Robert Mueller as special counsel and would prove to be among the most politically disastrous decisions since Richard Nixon fired Watergate prosecutor Archibald Cox. While Priebus and Bannon watched the fiasco explode as the pundits excoriated the Trump White House, on every cable news show, Kushner did a slow burn. He was livid, furious that the communications team could not defend Comey's firing. Bannon blew his stack. "There's not an effing thing you can do to sell this," he shouted at Kushner. "Nobody can sell this. P.T. Barnum couldn't sell this. People aren't stupid. This is a terrible, stupid decision that's going to have massive implications. It may have shortened Trump's presidency, and it's because of you, Jared Kushner." The screaming matches and white-knuckle showdowns continued. 8 days later, Priebus got an unexpected visit from the White House counsel, a story he has not told publicly before. "Don McGahn came in my office pretty hot, red, out of breath, and said, 'We've got a problem.' I responded, 'What?' And he said, 'Well, we just got a special counsel, and Attorney General Jeff Sessions just resigned.' I said, 'What? What the hell are you talking about?'" It was bad enough that Trump, having fired Comey, would now be the target of a special prosecutor. Even worse, unbeknownst to Priebus, the president, only moments before, had subjected Sessions to a withering tirade in the Oval Office, calling him an idiot and blaming Sessions' recusal from the Russia investigation for the whole mess. Humiliated, Sessions said he would resign. Priebus was incredulous. I said, "That can't happen." He bolted down the stairway to the West Wing parking lot. He found Sessions in the back seat of a black sedan, with the engine running. "I knocked on the door of the car, and Jeff was sitting there," Priebus said, "and I just jumped in and shut the door, and I said, 'Jeff, what's going on?' And then he told me that he was going to resign. I said, 'You cannot resign. It's not possible. We're going to talk about this right now.' So I dragged him back up to my office from the car. Vice President Mike Pence and Bannon came in, and we started talking to him to the point where he decided that he would not resign right then, and he would instead think about it. Later that night, Sessions delivered a resignation letter to the Oval Office, but Priebus claimed he ultimately persuaded the president to give it back. In June, Trump was still on a tear. He considered dumping Special Counsel Mueller, according to the New York Times, but was dissuaded from doing so. And by July, Trump was back on Sessions' case, tweeting insults and calling him weak. "Priebus was told to get Sessions' resignation flat out," said a White House insider. "The president told him, 'Don't give me any bullshit. Don't try to slow me down like you always do. Get the resignation of Jeff Sessions.'" "Once more, Priebus stalled Trump," recalled a White House insider. "He told the president, 'If I get this resignation, you are in for a spiral of calamity that makes Comey look like a picnic.' Rosenstein's going to resign. Associate Attorney General Rachel Brand, the number three, will say, 'Forget it. I'm not going to be involved with this, and it is going to be a total mess.' The president agreed to hold off. Sessions didn't comment on the resignation letter. And last July, publicly stated that he planned to stay on the job as long as that is appropriate. Brand, in fact, resigned this month. Next photos, all the president's ex-men. Former chief strategist Steve Bannon and Priebus. Trump, Priebus, Vice President Mike Pence, Bannon, one-time communications director Sean Spicer, and embattled national security advisor Michael Flynn. Priebus and Spicer. Priebus with ousted communications director Anthony Scaramucci. The Trump presidency's first 6 months were the most incompetent and least accomplished in modern history, and its very survival was clouded by the gathering storm of the special prosecutor's probe. When it came to Mueller's investigation, Priebus insisted he personally had nothing to worry about. But Bannon warned that the hounds had been loosed. You've got Mueller's team, which has got 19 killers who are all experts in wire fraud, money laundering, and tax evasion, Bannon said. Doesn't sound like collusion to me, but they've got unlimited budgets and subpoena power. And here's what we've got on our side. Two guys who've got legal pads and post-its. It's like certain members of the administration think that no one took down the Gambino family, Bannon continued. Mueller's doing a roll-up just like he did with the Gambinos. Former campaign manager Paul Manafort's the Capo Regime, right? And Rick Gates, Manafort's deputy, is a made man. George Papadopoulos is equivalent to a wise guy out in a social club in Brooklyn. This is like a Wagner opera. In the overture, you get all the strands of the music you're going to hear for 3 hours. Well, Mueller opened with a bang. He totally caught these guys by surprise. So if you're not going to fight, you're going to get rolled over. Meanwhile, Trump's campaign to eradicate Obamacare went nowhere. Repeal and replace crashed and burned, not once, but twice. The second time when John McCain delivered a dramatic 1:30 a.m. thumbs down on the Senate floor. The debacle proved that Priebus could not count or deliver votes. When McCain voted against it, Bannon recalled, I said to myself, Reince is gone. This is going to be so bad. The president is going to get so lit up. Priebus soon became a target of Trump's ritual belittling as the president took to referring to him as Reince. At one point, he summoned Priebus to swat a fly. Priebus seemed to have been willing to endure almost any indignity to stay in Trump's favor. There was that scene right out of The Manchurian Candidate when at a cabinet meeting, the president's most powerful advisers virtually competed to see who could be more obsequious. Priebus won hands down, declaring what a blessing it was to serve the president. By the summer, however, Priebus knew that his job hung by a thread. According to insiders, he was already in the crosshairs of Jovanka Jarvanka, as Bannon would take to calling the president's daughter and son-in-law, for refusing to help Kushner in his efforts to oust Bannon. And then came the last straw, the sudden arrival of a new flamboyant communications director, Anthony Scaramucci. Priebus had opposed his hiring. Scaramucci immediately turned the West Wing into a circular firing squad, calling Trump's chief of staff an effing paranoid schizophrenic in an interview with The New Yorker. He went on in a tweet to all but accuse Priebus of leaking classified information about Scaramucci's finances, which were publicly available. When he accused me of a felony, recalled Priebus, I thought, what am I doing here? I went into the president and said, I gotta go. Trump would say nothing publicly in Priebus's defense. The president accepted his resignation. Priebus had hoped to exit gracefully within a week or two, but the next day, as Air Force One sat on the tarmac at Andrews Air Force Base, Trump tweeted, "I am pleased to inform you that I have just named General Secretary John F. Kelly as White House Chief of Staff. He is a great American." The sudden shakeup was vintage Trump. The timing blindsided Priebus, who stepped off the plane into a drenching rain and was whisked away by car. John Kelly, a 4-star Marine general who had run the Southern Command, was 22 years Priebus' senior. At the start, he had the president's full confidence and wasted no time transforming the West Wing into a tighter ship. All visitors to the Oval Office, including Bannon, Kushner, and even the president's advisor daughter, Ivanka, were now vetted by the chief. Kelly also started heaving loose cannons over the side. Scaramucci was fired within 72 hours of Kelly's appointment. Sebastian Gorka, another overzealous White House staffer, would soon follow. Even Bannon himself would be gone within a month. Kelly declared that he was not put on earth to manage the president. Instead, he would impose discipline on the staff and streamline the flow of information to the Oval Office. Still, expectations were high that Kelly would be the grown-up in the room who would smooth over Trump's authoritarian edges. And yet, week after week, during the president's fulminations against fake news, his sympathetic comments toward white supremacists who marched through Charlottesville, his taunting of Rocket Man before the UN General Assembly, and his racist slurs against shithole countries, Kelly stood at Trump's side. He not only reinforced the president's worst instincts, he doubled down on them. He maligned Congresswoman Frederica Wilson from the White House press briefing room with a false story after she criticized Trump's handling of a Gold Star widow. In early February, the news broke that Kelly's deputy, Rob Porter, accused of beating both of his ex-wives, Porter denied the allegations, had served in the sensitive post of staff secretary for more than a year without a permanent security clearance. The debacle surrounding his abrupt resignation showed that Kelly could not manage the West Wing, let alone Trump. Suddenly, Kelly's future looked uncertain, and Priebus looked more effective in hindsight. Reince was better than his press, said Bannon. If Reince had the exact track record that Kelly has, he would be deemed the worst chief of staff in the history of politics. And that's not a slam on Kelly. Folks felt Priebus didn't have the gravitas. He's always the little guy from Kenosha, right?
Thank you.
Now, a Vanity Fair Spotlight by Rebecca Keegan, Celestial Navigation. With a photograph of Oprah Winfrey and Storm Reid in A Wrinkle in Time. The sun had just gone down outside a soundstage 40 miles north of Los Angeles when a shimmering celestial being appeared, with blonde tendrils, iridescent lips, and an hourglass figure. She radiated power, wisdom, and kindness. Oprah Winfrey, in a dress covered with lights. "It's a little warm in here, with all the current going through the body," Winfrey said, raising her bejeweled eyebrows at costume designer Paco Delgado, who flashed a nervous smile. It was March 2017, on the set of A Wrinkle in Time, Ava DuVernay's adaptation of Madeline L'Engle's classic fantasy novel, which Disney is releasing this month. In a bit of typecasting, Winfrey plays Mrs. Witch, a supernatural being who is the wisest entity in the world. "As I read the script, I heard the voices of Maya Angelou and Glinda the Good Witch in my head, and my own stuff that I've said and thought, yeah, I could do that," Winfrey said while the crew set up the next shot against a blue screen. In the book, as in the movie, which Frozen writer and co-director Jennifer Lee adapted for the screen, a teenager named Meg Murray, Storm Reid, travels through time and space to find her missing scientist father, Chris Pine. Along the way, she is aided by an ancient trio, Mrs. Witch, Mrs. What's-It, Reese Witherspoon, and Mrs. Who, Mindy Kaling. Though L'Engle's 1962 book is beloved for its courageous, bookish heroine, and its ideas have often been mined by other science fiction and fantasy filmmakers, DuVernay's film is the work's first big-screen adaptation. A TV movie version aired in 2004. It is also the first live-action movie with a production budget of more than $100 million to be directed by a woman of color, with a cast and crew reflective of DuVernay's deeply felt beliefs about inclusion, right down to the 14-year-old Reed, who is biracial. DuVernay, who has directed two Oscar-nominated films, the Martin Luther King Jr. drama Selma, and 13th, a documentary about race and incarceration, first met with Disney about its planned Marvel adaptation Black Panther. She later took the Wrinkle in Time job after determining that the studio's rules for its comic book characters might be too rigid for her. Wrinkle felt like an open field, and one where she could create a long-wished-for image of a heroine. To see a girl of color hopping planets and saving the universe is important in the culture for all kinds of people, DuVernay said. That Reed's Meg is also guided on her journey by women deepens the meaning. In the film, Meg learns how to travel in the fifth dimension, or Tesser in the parlance of the book, from Winfrey's Mrs. Witch, in a scene that harks back to the inspirational advice the former talk show host has doled out to her TV audience and friends through the years. When they're tessering for the first time, and Mrs. Witch is explaining that it's finding your flow, having faith in who you are. "Well, I've said that to my girls 100 times, Winfrey said. "That's what life is, finding your lane, being able to align with whatever is your real purpose, who you really are, being true to yourself." DuVernay's movie will expose L'Engle and Winfrey's expansive ideas to a new generation. "I picture 2 years from now, a year from now, being someplace and kids recognizing me as Mrs. Witch," Winfrey said, "and their parents saying, 'No, honey, that's Oprah. She used to have a talk show.'" We'll be right back. Now here's this month's Proust questionnaire with an illustration by Risco, Sally Mann, soon to publish 1,000 Crossings, a book accompanying her new exhibition at the National Gallery of Art. The photographer talks ancient cars, Frederick Douglass, and galloping across the countryside on horseback. What is your current state of mind? Right now, I am worried that there is no way to be both clever and real in answering these questions. In a more general sense, I am worried about the state of the Republic, the environment, and the world, like most people reading this. Which living person do you most admire? Barack Obama. What is your idea of perfect happiness? Reading, and in particular, reading on the deck of the cabin while my children play in the river below. When and where were you happiest? On the island of Bahia, one summer, out of the blue, a benefactor, thank you, Charlene, flew our entire family there and put us up in a cliffside house that was a weird mixture of Gaudi and Fred Flintstone, and where we went to sleep at 8 and got up at 5. In between, we read, swam, hiked, and unknowingly enjoyed the last moment before the irrevocable sheer of adolescence set in. What or who is the greatest love of your life? Larry Mann, 48 years. What is your favorite journey? The one that brings me home. What is your greatest extravagance? Privacy, and to secure that, the compulsive urge to purchase the land next to mine. What is your greatest fear? The loss of a child. What is your greatest regret? Not having more time. Which talent would you most like to have? A photographic memory. If you could change one thing about your family, what would it be? That there would be 5 of us again. What do you consider your greatest achievement? The next good picture. Which historical figure do you most identify with? Sisyphus. What is your most treasured possession? To the extent that I can claim it, my memory. What do you consider the most overrated virtue? Cleanliness. On what occasion do you lie when I accuse the dogs of farting? What do you dislike most about your appearance? The smile that my face makes when I don't mean it. What do you regard as the lowest depth of misery? I've been there and I don't want to talk about it. What is your favorite occupation? Driving around with the windows rolled down looking for pictures in a car so ancient that it still has a cassette player on, which I can play all my old mixtapes from, back when life was so uncomplicated I could do this all the time. What is your most marked characteristic? A peasant-like capacity for work. What do you most value in your friends? Knowing when to show up and when to go home. Who is your favorite hero of fiction? Scout. Who are your heroes in real life? Virginia Carter, the woman who raised me, civil rights activist, and especially Willie Lewis and Moses Wright, teachers, therapists, and community volunteers. And I've heard that Frederick Douglass has been doing some great things lately. What is it that you most dislike? Large gatherings, inefficiency, snakes showing up where I don't expect them, wastefulness, people don't return my books, glass elevators, and dangled prepositions. If you were to die and could choose what to come back as, what would it be? One of my dogs. How would you like to die? Quickly, without warning, maybe even in my sleep. And while we're putting in request, before I lose my mind and my ability to gallop across the countryside on horseback. And that was the Proust questionnaire with Sally Mann. This program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. I'm Nancy Jones, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service and broadcasting from its Raleigh, North Carolina studios. Vanity Fair Part A airs via special subchannel receiver on Saturday and Sunday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Vanity Fair Part B airs via special subchannel receiver on Monday and Tuesday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Both parts A and B are available as a podcast. Opening and closing music by Calexico. Interval selections by Mark Hoffman.